Hey, good morning, everybody. Hello, hello. Let me turn the volume up a little bit. This is Bio 241, May 5th, Tuesday. Let's take a look at the schedule. We're in the respiratory chapter. We started that a little early last time, but that's okay, because usually we run out of time. All those lectures are online. That's real nice. Okay, so the schedule is on the right-hand side. Today is the 5th. So we're going to get into respiratory system, finish that up maybe next time. A couple of lectures on renal physiology, maybe a lecture on diversification system. And then your last exam, which is going to be on a Thursday. So when is that? That's two and a half weeks away from today. Right, 2.5 weeks from today. These are the chapters that are on that test. And then chapter 20, right, we'll have to tell you what questions I like at the end of the chapter, what exam figures I like, and there aren't many exam figures for that particular chapter, so there's not many. Okay, and somebody's got to remind me to make sure that I get an extra credit assignment out to you sometime soon, before next week, right? And there's two more extra credit assignments due.
Are they both going to be pictures?
Yeah, they're both going to be drawings. Yeah, drawings. One's an equation, but just draw the equation out and hopefully it makes sense. Okay, it's a blood flow equation. Okay, anybody have a question on schedule? You're all pretty good with that. All right, I'm going to turn some of these lights down. Let's see. I think maybe that was part of the problem. Blackboard email has not been working, and even my gateway email hasn't been working, so we might have to work together on that. I might have to give you a hard copy of it, okay? So I probably should have that done by Thursday, okay? Unless email is back working. I'm not sure. Okay, so we were talking about lungs last time, and we talked about surface area, right? So what is that structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lung called? Okay. Yeah, it's partly made up of a capillary. Yeah, the alveolus. The alveolus. Okay, here you guys. So this is going to be important for you to get a good handle of this. So an alveolus has a special shape to maximize exchange of gases across the respiratory membrane. Right, and rats, I got distracted a second. What was I wanting to tell you? Okay, the shape of the alveolus. Okay, I remember what it was. All right, so remember there's about 300 million alveoli, and if we were to take them and flatten them all out and put all of them next to each other, what would be the surface area of all those alveoli added up together? Like if we took an orange and peeled it and put it on the table, peel another orange, put it here, and we did 300 million oranges, how big would that tabletop have to be? Yeah, half of a tennis court, right? About 80 square meters, somewhere between 60 and 80 square meters. And so what is surface area? I think I gave you a demonstration. We measured surface area of something last time. What was that? Yes, the doorway, right? It was 1 by 2 meters exactly, so the surface area of that door is 2 square meters. So when I say surface area, what do I really want you to think of in real terms, day in and day out terms? Surface area, okay. Surface area for exchange, it might make sense, but when I say surface area, what should you be thinking of? A doorway for exchange, right? And exchange and the surface area or the size of the doorway they're directly related to each other. So if the doorway increases, the size of the doorway increases, what happens to exchange? It increases. It gets faster, right? All right, so that's really what I wanted you to know. That's going to be, that's important for you to know. Okay, so let's go back and look at the thoracic cavity. So here's a nice transverse section. I can see some lungs. And remember, the lungs are in a cavity that is not open to the outside world, so it has a special kind of membrane around it. And what kind of membrane is that? It's a serous membrane. A little bit complicated. It's not just like a mucous membrane that has one layer, but a serous membrane has two. So here we see the lungs, in the thoracic cavity. Since it's deep inside a body cavity, we call that a visceral organ. And so here is the organ, and I see a membrane right on top of the lungs, this visceral organ. That's going to be the first part of the serous membrane, which is the, somebody just told me, yeah, that's the visceral serous membrane. But since the membrane on the lungs is what we call pleural, we call that what? The visceral pleural membrane. And so it goes all the way over here, right? And then it folds back on itself. It folds back all the way over. And now that exact same membrane is not on the surface of the lungs, but it's on the inside surface of the thoracic cavity. And since that's a little bit different spot than on the surface of the lung, we have to come up with a different name. And we call that the parietal division of that serous membrane, or the parietal pleura. And of course, every serous membrane has a space between these two membranes, between the visceral and parietal, and we're going to call that the pleural cavity, and it's filled with serous fluid, like all other serous fluids are, but it's a very thin layer. Okay, we talked about an alveolus last time. I think, did we talk about an alveolus last time? And that it could have trouble inflating because there's water on the inside of an alveolus. And what can you tell me some physical properties about water? Is water sticky or is it slippery? It's very sticky, right? So this fluid in the pleural cavity does not have surfactant. It has water, which makes it sticky, right? So that helps attach the lung to the thoracic wall so that when the thorax changes shape, so does the lungs. There's something else that's going to be important to see, but that is one thing, right? This pleural cavity does not have surfactant, so the lungs are stuck to the thoracic cavity because water is sticky. So that's sometimes what we call the intrapleural space. Intrapleural is the space between the pleural membranes, right? It's the space between the visceral and parietal pleura. Some of the language in this chapter can be a little bit confusing because they use different names for talking about the same space. All right, so let's look at some physical aspects of ventilation. And air is a fluid, just like blood is a fluid. It can flow from one place to another. And what will allow a fluid to move? What pushes a fluid around?
Concentration gradient.
Okay, concentration gradient would be really good for diffusion, but it's really similar to concentration gradient, and that is pressure. Okay, all right, so pressure, and so how will a fluid flow according to pressure? Just like for diffusion, from high pressure to low pressure. All right, so it won't go from low pressure to high pressure. So ventilation, or air moving in and out of our lungs, is a result of pressure differences, which are induced by changes in lung volumes. Right, so air moves from high pressure to low, and the lung has some compliance, it has elasticity. Right, and we have to consider surface tension. Once you get all of these things, influence ventilation. So what is this compliance? What does that mean, compliance? Compliance is how easily something can expand and contract, how pliable it is. And I guess a good way to think about this is, what would have more compliance, a balloon or a tire? Right, and we're going to put air in both. And if we put a little bit of pressure in a balloon, you'll notice that it's going to change volume. And if we put a little bit of pressure inside a car tire, then the volume is not going to change, right? So a car tire is not compliant, but that balloon is. All right, there's something else, too. I think the tire and the balloon example work really good, and that is elasticity. And remember, elasticity has to do when you stretch something out and let go, what happens? It goes back to its original length, right? So if we stretch out a balloon and let go, right, it's highly elastic, it will go back to its initial length. And that car tire, okay, when you stretch it out, it won't. It doesn't have elastic properties in it. Right, so if you have a tire that's at a very high air pressure and one is just sitting on the ground, not even attached to a wheel, just sitting there, it still has basically the same shape. Right, it doesn't have those elastic properties. Okay, intrapulmonary pressure. Intrapulmonary is, all right, the pressure inside the lungs. Sometimes you might want to call that the intraalveolar pressure. Well, that's another way of thinking about it. Intrapleural pressure, remember, is the pressure that's inside that serous cavity, right, or the pleural cavity. Right, so we just got done saying that the visceral and the parietal membranes usually touch each other, and since there's water in there, they get stuck together. And so the thoracic wall and the lungs expand and contract together because they are stuck together. Okay. Intrapleural space, yeah, contains that water, right, which is sticky fluid. All right, so this is something that is going to help explain why the lungs expand and contract with changes of the thoracic cavity. All right, so during inspiration, intrapulmonary pressure, I'll tell you, is about intrapulmonary. Where the heck is intrapulmonary? Inside the lungs, yes, inside the lungs, is about minus 3 millimeters of mercury pressure compared to atmospheric pressure. So it's below atmospheric pressure. And we said that's during inspiration. So if that space inside your lungs is below atmospheric pressure, what is air going to want to do? High pressure to low. Where is low pressure? Inside your lungs. So air will flow from the atmosphere into your lungs because that intrapulmonary pressure is a lot lower. During expiration, if we want to get air out of our lungs, what has to happen to pressure in this intrapulmonary space? It's got to be higher than atmospheric pressure, right? And exactly that's what happens. It's about 3 millimeters of mercury greater than atmospheric pressure so that air flows out over our lungs. Well, it's really important that our lungs keep inflated, that match the size of the thoracic wall, because they will collapse if something special isn't done. And so we want to measure the pressure not only from inside the lungs or the intrapulmonary pressure and atmospheric pressure, we want to look at the pressure that is just across the wall of the lungs, the pressure from the intrapulmonary pressure and the intrapleural pressure. What's the difference there? And since we want the lungs to be inflated all the time, we would like for that to be a positive number. We would like for the lungs always to be pushed up against the wall of the thorax, right? Okay. So let's look at some pressures, right? We got intrapulmonary, that's inside the lungs. We got intrapleural, which is in that serous cavity or the pleural cavity. And then we have the difference between those two. We call that the transmural or transpulmonary pressure. Transpulmonary and transmural mean the same. It just means the pressure across the wall of the lungs. That's what transmural means. Okay, so intrapulmonary pressure on inspiration, the pressure inside the lungs drops to minus 3 millimeters of mercury. The intrapleural pressure, right, in that serous space, drops to minus 6. And so if we subtract these from each other, we see that the pressure inside the lungs compared to the pleural space is 3 millimeters of mercury greater. So that's going to have a tendency to push the lungs out to the wall of the thoracic cavity. That's on inspiration. And that same effect should happen even on expiration because we don't want the lungs to collapse, right? So on expiration, what has to be this pressure inside the lungs? Greater or less than atmospheric pressure on expiration? Greater. And here it is, right? Greater by 3 millimeters of mercury. The intrapleural pressure also increases from 6 to minus 3. And if we subtract these two, notice that we still have a positive pressure inside the lungs, right, in that intrapulmonary space compared to the intrapleural space, which is going to have a tendency to keep the lungs inflated. So even no matter if it's inspiration or expiration, this pressure, this transmural pressure across the wall of the lungs is going to keep the lungs inflated, right, as long as this intrapleural space is nice and continuous, it doesn't have a hole in it, right? For instance, if somebody gets a chest injury to where there is a hole that goes from the atmosphere into this intrapleural space, then the pressure in the intrapleural space is always going to be atmospheric pressure, right? It can't change because of that hole right there. And when that happens, then the lungs will collapse, and that's called a pneumothorax when that happens. Okay, so this intrapleural space has to have that integrity. It can't ever be open to the outside air pressure. Okay, here is a pretty important law. This will explain how air moves in and out of our lungs. It's called Boyle's Law. And we see by Boyle's Law, it's a relationship between pressure and volume. And what's a really nice way, simple way of looking at this equation and saying what's going on here? There's an inverse relationship between pressure and volume, right? So if pressure increases, what happens to volume? It decreases, right? If pressure decreases, what happens to volume? It increases. Or we could go the other way around, and that's maybe even a better way of thinking about it, right? If we increase volume, what happens to pressure? It goes down, right? Just always think inversion. And if volume goes down, what happens to pressure? It increases, right? So that's the basic mechanism by which air is moved in and out of our lungs. It's by changing the volume of the thoracic cavity or changing the volume of the lungs, right? Because the lungs are glued to the chest wall. Okay, so these changes in intrapulmonary pressure, right, change how gas flows either in and out of our lungs. And that is due to changes in size of the thoracic cavity. So an increase in lung volume decreases that pressure inside the lungs, causing inspiration, right? A decreased pressure compared to atmospheric pressure inside the lungs. And which way will a fluid flow from? High to low. So if the pressure is low inside the lungs, air is going to flow in, right? If there's a decrease in lung volume, what happens to pressure? Decrease in volume? Decrease in volume is an increase in pressure, right? And we say intrapulmonary pressure, so that's a pressure inside the lungs. So the pressure inside your lungs is increasing when the volume decreases, right? Atmospheric pressure stays the same. So now the pressure inside your lungs is higher than atmospheric pressure. And how does fluid flow? From high to low. So air will flow out of your lungs as a result of that. Maybe some of you have used a bellows at one point in time, maybe to help start a fire. Anybody think of a bellows? Anybody seen a bellows? Kind of triangular thing with two handles on it and a little nozzle, right? And you can move it up and down. You can increase the volume of the bellows by moving the handles apart. And which is air going to move when you do that? It's going to move into the bellows, because what did you do to the volume of the bellows? You increase the volume and you then decrease the pressure so that air flows in. Same principle for your lungs. And when you push the handles of the bellows together, the volume decreases. What happens to pressure? Volume decreases, pressure increases. That forces air out of the bellows. Exactly the same way that ventilation occurs. And also, that's an important thing for returning blood to the heart, right? That was what we call the respiratory pump. Every time you decrease the pressure of venous blood, when you inspire, that helps suck blood up into your thoracic cavity because it's decreasing the pressure. Okay, elasticity. Surface tension, we talked about a little bit. All right. And I think we've even looked at this slide once before. I'm going to go back to that previous slide in just a little bit. But we've zoomed way in to an alveolus, right? So here is air inside the alveolus. And here is the wall of the alveolus. Can anybody tell me what kind of wall this looks like? It's an epithelium. It's a simple squamous epithelium, right? And then here is the endothelium of a capillary very nearby. And what kind of epithelium is that? A simple squamous. So both of these are specialized for exchange. Right, so diffusion can move across these very thin cells, and I see a little interstitial space between these two cells, and it's been exaggerated a little bit on this illustration so that you can see it, but it's going to be very, very thin. And so that's sometimes what we call the respiratory membrane. What is the membrane that gases have to pass across to get from air in the alveolus to fluid in the circulatory system, right? When oxygen leaves the air and it goes into the blood, what does it have to traverse? Yeah, the respiratory membrane. And typically in books, that respiratory membrane is defined as wall of the capillary, interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, interstitial space, and wall of the capillary. Doesn't matter which order you say. Okay, but on this illustration, maybe you should include one other layer. I see one other layer. And it's exaggerated in size as well. And that is, I see wall of capillary, interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, and then what's on top of that? Surfactant, right? So that surfactant is really important. If there's no surfactant there, what's going to happen to this alveolus? It won't expand. It will collapse and the walls will get stuck together because water is sticky. But here, so these simple squamous, or these squamous cells are type 1 alveolar cells that make up the wall of the alveolus. Here is a type 2 alveolar cell, and it's responsible for secreting surfactant onto the surface of the alveolus. And what does that surfactant do? Yeah, it prevents a collapse, prevents the sticking together of those two surfaces, nearby surfaces of an alveolus. So we could do a really quick experiment. All right, so I have two transparencies right here, right? Nothing much to them. And I could stick these transparencies together, right? So they're nice and together, and I'll make sure that they're touching each other. They're glued together, right? And they're offset just a little bit, so I can grab one without grabbing the other. And if I just hold on to one, what's going to happen to the other one? It's just going to slide right down, right? You might have to catch it. Ah, I glued them together too much. Okay, so they do fall apart. All right, but let's glue them together. Who's got some glue? Anybody have some glue? You don't have any glue? Okay, but we got glue right here, right? What is this glue right here? It's water. All right, so we got some glue. Put some water on there. Did you get wet? No, good. Okay. All right, so I put some glue on there, and I got these two transparencies, and they're stuck together. I'm holding both of them, and if I let go of one, what's going to happen to the other one? It's going to get stuck, right? It just stays there. Now, how much tension is there? I want somebody to pull, like, right on that little corner right there. Okay. Oh, it slid apart pretty fast. I'm surprised it was so fast. But there was a lot of tension there. Okay. Sometimes I can actually lift somebody right up off their seat because there's so much tension. Okay. All right, so that surfactant then would allow those two sheets to separate very, very easily. And what's the kind of cell responsible for secreting? Yeah, it's a type 2 alveolar cell. Now, sometimes those type 2 alveolar cells aren't working. For instance, in a premature baby that's delivered very, very early, those alveolar cells aren't secreting, so their lungs will not inflate. Oh, I did mention that last time, right? So they have way decreased pulmonary function, and to help them, they're just put in a higher than normal oxygen concentration, right? And so oxygen will have a greater tendency to diffuse into their bodies. That's generally a good thing. Maybe talk to me after class as to why it might not be a really good thing. Sometimes it's a concern. Okay, so newborn babies without alveolar type 2 cells, we call that respiratory distress syndrome, or RDS. And there can be a similar condition that develops in an adult. We're going to call that acute respiratory distress syndrome. And that's due to cardiovascular collapse when somebody goes into shock. And what happens there is fluid builds up in the lungs. That prevents these type 2 cells from secreting fluid, and their lungs have a tendency to collapse. Okay, mechanics of breathing. We sort of talked about this already. Here I have a couple plain films, just x-ray films of somebody's chest. And here on the top picture shows somebody that's about ready to take a breath. All right, so they're relaxed. And the diaphragm is kind of a dome-shaped structure. It goes up to the base of the lungs. All right, so this is what we can see is the shape of the lungs when the body is at rest before inspiration. Then this person is going to take a breath, and let's look and see what happens to the volume of the lungs. Right, so the diaphragm moves from here all the way down to here. The chest wall expands as well. Right, because of some external intercostal muscles. So the diaphragm increases the volume. There's lateral motion of the thoracic cage, so that greatly increases the volume, right, the intrapulmonary volume. So what happens to the pressure? it decreases, so air flows in under this circumstance. All right, and because muscles have elasticity, right, when the diaphragm relaxes, it goes back up to its normal dome-shaped position, decreasing the volume of the lungs, increasing the pressure in that intrapulmonary space, so then air flows out. And I have an example of that right here. All right, so I have a good diaphragm that's going to change shape. I have a thoracic cavity, but it's just made out of plastic or glass, so it's not going to change shape. So I can't change the volume of this thoracic cavity with the wall of the thorax, but the diaphragm I can. Can you see the diaphragm at the bottom right here, this nice dark rubber? Okay, and then the two balloons represent lungs, and here's a hole that represents like a trachea, for instance, right? Or you could think nostril or whatever, right? But that is a passageway, not into, right, the space between the lungs and this glass jar, but that just is leading right to inside the balloons, right? So how could we inflate these balloons? What would we have to do to the volume of this container? Okay, we want to increase the volume of the container, and that will do what to the pressure inside the container? Decrease the pressure, atmospheric pressure will be the same, so what do you predict about these balloons when we increase? They will inflate, because initially their pressure will be lower until air flows in. All right, so I'm not going to occlude that trachea. I'm going to increase the volume by pulling down on the diaphragm. And does anybody see, can you, anybody see the balloons in there? I can see them. Maybe the people in the first couple rows. All right, so I'm going to increase the volume, and you see the lungs inflate. You did. What about if I decrease the volume? They deflated. All right, so here's just a really nice, simple example of how we ventilate. By increasing or decreasing the volume of the thoracic cavity. All right, so that's a pretty good visual. There are some muscles responsible for breathing, and I probably have to tell you there are two kinds of breathing. There is something we call quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now. And there is a kind of breathing we call forced breathing, and that's when you are exercising. So your respiratory rate is faster and deeper, right, when you're hyperventilating, when you're exercising. Let's look at quiet breathing first. Let's look at the muscles of inspiration. Well, we know that the diaphragm is probably the most important muscle for inspiration. Look at how hugely dome-shaped it is when it contracts, right? It depresses inferiorly to a great degree. And these parasternals, external intercostals, sternal cleidomastoid, and scalenes are not used very much. It's mostly just the diaphragm. Okay. On expiration, quiet breathing is completely passive. It doesn't require any of these muscles right here. It just requires that the diaphragm stops contracting and it goes back to this dome-shaped structure. And what can you tell me about the alveolus? We said something about that. Your anatomy book had a really good picture. And I got a couple models of what an alveolus could be like. I have this right here. It just so happens to be Cinco de Mayo, but there's no connection between that. Okay, so I have an alveolus here, and I have an alveolus here. Which one, tell me in a little bit, which one, okay, would be a better example, a better model of an alveolus? Well, we need to inflate these, right? So let's inflate this paper bag. Okay, so air is going to go in. Okay, so I have air in this paper bag. The alveolus is inflated, right? And now I'm going to open up this alveolus, and what's going to happen to all this air trapped inside the paper bag? It's going to be what? It's just going to stay stuck because the volume of that paper bag can't change, right? So the pressure is not going to change in there. Now here I have a balloon. Oh good, it didn't pop. I'm always kind of, I don't want it to pop because balloons have a hard life here in the building for some reason. Okay, so now if I let go of the balloon, what's going to happen to the air inside the balloon? It will escape, and that's because what's the property of this balloon right here? not only is it highly compliant, right, because I can't generate a whole lot of pressure when I blow into it, but it also has elasticity, right? And air is going to flow out just because of that passive elasticity. Oh, good. There it goes. All right, so what's a better model of an alveolus? The balloon is much better, right? And so around every alveolus in your body, there is a network of elastic fibers, right? So when the diaphragm contracts, that will help expiration. Okay, that's for quiet breathing. So the strange thing about quiet breathing is that expiration does not require any muscle contraction, only inspiration. Now that's going to be different for deep breathing or forced breathing, okay? And we need to recruit some other muscles because we need to elevate the rib cage laterally and also anteriorly, right? So we have these external intercostals will do that. They will pull on each other, the parasternals, and don't forget about the diaphragm, but that's not going to work on the thoracic cage, but these other muscles will. All right, so when the external intercostals start to pull down on the rib cage, we got to have some other muscles that are way superior to help stabilize these first couple ribs. And, okay, there's where the scalenes come into play. So the scalenes kind of act as an anchor point so that these other muscles, right, can pull on it and elevate the rib cage. And maybe even to some extent the sternocleidomastoid. So this is for deep breathing. For expiration, right, we need to move air out of our lungs very fast. Elasticity of the diaphragm and the alveolus is not enough. And so there are some muscles that are necessary to help expel air from our thoracic cavity. And that's where the internal intercostals will pull the ribs down. We have some external oblique muscles, right? We have a rectus abdominis, transverse, and internal oblique muscles. So when any of these abdominal muscles contract, then all of the contents in the abdominal cavity will be compressed and pushed up into the diaphragm, right? And that will help decrease the size of the thorax. All right, so abdominal muscles, when you're breathing heavily or deeply, are used to help expel air. So for deep breathing, both inspiration and expiration require muscle. For quiet breathing, only inspiration are muscles necessary. Okay. Here is a pretty good example. Okay, one of these is wrong. There's a pretty good example of what's happening when we inhale. Let's look at this one. This one might be the correct one. And I think this might be in your book. If you have a book that has atmospheric pressure at 769 millimeters of mercury, that is not correct. Right, the standard is 760. Right, so that's why I have that slide in there. So here we have atmospheric pressure at the standard pressure, 760. Okay, and so what are we looking at? The diaphragm, okay, nice dome shape. I see the intrapulmonary pressure at 760. Atmospheric pressure is 760. Which one is higher? They're equal, so which way is air going to go? It's not going to move one way or the other, right? Because the pressure is the same. You need a pressure difference. And are the lungs are they inflated up against the chest wall? Because look at this intrapleural pressure inside the space is what? 756, right? And the pressure inside the lungs is 760. And so the pressure inside the lungs is actually going to force, right, the lungs up against the chest wall. So that's important so that the lungs don't collapse. Okay, so now what do we do? Well, let's contract this diaphragm and increase the volume of the thoracic cavity. What happens to the pressure inside the lungs when we increase their volume? It decreases. And did it decrease? It went from 760 to 757. That's at 3 millimeters of mercury that we were talking about. That's enough of a pressure difference to inflate the lungs. And what about that pressure inside the pleural cavity or the intrapleural space? Okay, it is still lower than the intrapulmonary pressure, and that helps keep the lungs inflated. All right, so under these circumstances, because air pressure is higher, air is going to flow in the lungs, but the lungs don't collapse because of that even greater negative pressure in the intrapulmonary space. Okay, on expiration, right, then the volume, can you see that these lungs right here are a lot smaller? Right, so the third condition, the volume has changed. The volume has gone down. What happens to pressure? It goes up, right? So now it's at 763. But fortunately, okay, the pressure in this intrapleural space is still less than the intrapulmonary pressure, right? And so the lungs still stay attached to the wall of the chest, the thoracic cage, right? So the lungs don't collapse. And that's something that you kind of have to consider because these lungs have elastic properties, right? So these lungs would collapse if there wasn't a negative pressure right here because of what? All the elastic fibers around all those alveoli. Okay.
Question.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
let's go back to this picture right here.
So you
Here, right here. Collapse of the lung. Yeah. But if this pleural cavity, for some reason, is open to the outside world, maybe you have a puncture of the chest, then the pressure in this intrapleural space, instead of 754, is going to be what? What's atmospheric pressure? 760. So instead of 754, this is 760. What's the pressure inside the lungs, intrapulmonary? Is 757. Its pressure is higher in this pleural space. That's going to force the collapse of this lung. Okay? But if this thoracic cavity or the pleural cavity is nicely contained, there's no damage to it, that will maintain the inflation of the lungs up against the thoracic wall. But you can't have a chest injury into this pleural cavity. That's called a pneumothorax when that happens. Okay, I promised you I was going to go back a couple slides. Where was I going to go back? Ah, right here. Surface tension. If there wasn't surfactant, okay, there is a physics principle that says that pressure in the alveolus is proportional to the surface tension, okay, and inversely related to the alveolus. So pressure is inversely related to the size, the radius of the alveolus. So here we have a couple alveoli, right? And I have one with a very small radius, one with a large radius. Which one has a higher pressure? Okay. This is without surfactant. Which one has a higher pressure? The one with a smaller radius. Okay. And as a result, since the one with a smaller radius has higher pressure compared to one with a larger radius, what's going to happen to this air? Where is it going to flow? From high to low. It is high in the low alveolus, right? And it's going to flow into this large one. So without surfactant, where would all the air flow? It basically flow into the largest alveolus that's in your lungs, and the rest of the alveoli would collapse. So that's another important function of surfactant, by reducing surface tension. It equalizes the pressure between all alveoli, no matter what size they are, so that air flows into each of them pretty much equally. Okay? So that's another important thing. Okay, mechanics of breathing. Well, we're really interested to know the volumes that we have inside of our lungs and how they behave under certain kinds of conditions. And we measure that with an instrument called a spirometer. And the study of lung volumes with a spirometer is called spirometry. And probably you've done some of this in lab. All right, so here is. Anytime you take any kind of physiology class, you're going to see this diagram. So this is an important exam figure. All right, and this is just a graph of lung volume, right, versus time, and then during time this person is doing some natural breathing and some special breathing kind of techniques, like a deep inspiration or deep expiration. All right, so what's a normal total lung volume? Yeah, so it's almost 6,000 liters, not quite, right? So 5,700 liters is pretty much the typical textbook. And I see a certain volume between 0 and about 1,200 mLs right here, and that's called residual volume. This is the amount of air that's inside your lungs that's always going to stay there no matter how hard you try to exhale, right? This volume is just trapped inside the lungs. It can never leave, residual volume. Okay, and then I see a volume that goes up and down, up and down, up and down, kind of reminded somebody of the ocean tides, right? So this is the normal volume that we inhale and exhale from our body when we're breathing quietly, right? And that's what you're doing right now. And we can see that it is less than 500 mLs, but about 500 mLs is what we move in and out of our lungs when we're not exercising. Well, we know that we can change our lung volume drastically. So at the end of a normal expiration, what can you do? Can you expel some more air out of your lungs? Go ahead, try that. Exhale normally. And then how do you get more air out of your lungs? Contract the abdominal muscles, right? So you can blow out. And as hard as you can, right, you still can't get rid of this residual volume, right? So this amount from a normal expiration to this minimum, we call that expiratory reserve. And it's a reserve because you could use that volume when you go from quiet to forced breathing. All right, there's also another one. At the top of a normal inspiration, right, you still have a lot of reserve left in your lungs. You can inhale even more, right? You can go and really inflate your lungs. That's what we call inspiratory reserve. Right, so you got an expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve, and tidal volume and residual volume, which we've talked about so far. So volumes we can measure independently. If we combine volumes together to add up some of these, right, we get something we call a capacity. And there's one capacity that I want you to know, and it's the capacity in your lungs that you can actually use when you're in a forced breathing situation. So that's what? The tidal volume, then the expiratory reserve and inspiratory reserve. That's the full functional capacity, right, of your lungs. And we call that vital capacity. A capacity is just a sum of some basic volume. Vital capacity is just the amount of air, the whole volume that you can move in and out of your lungs voluntarily. Okay, so this is a really good example for you. Is there anything else I want to say about this? Not in this particular case. Okay, some things that affect gas exchange. Well, there's another law right here, and just says that the total pressure in some kind of container, right, is equal to all the partial pressures of the different kinds of gases that are in that container. So what are some gases in our atmosphere? Nitrogen gas, and it's mostly nitrogen, and oxygen, carbon dioxide. And when water evaporates, it becomes a gas, so there, it contributes. And all of these things have to add up to 760 millimeters of mercury. Millimeters of mercury is just a measure of pressure. Okay, so how do these things change? Well, when air is entering our body, CO2 is almost zero, right? CO2 in the air is almost zero. There's some, depending on humidity, there's some water vapor. Here's a pretty standard measure of oxygen as we breathe in. It's 159 millimeters of mercury, but most of the air that we're breathing in is nitrogen. You can see that it's 601 millimeters of mercury, and this all adds up to 760. But by the time all this air gets in the lung and exchange takes place, right, the air has been humidified, so the partial pressure of water has gone way up. And what about CO2? Okay. The partial pressure of CO2 has increased, right? So which way is CO2 going to want to move? From alveolar air, okay, just by diffusion, or into the atmosphere? It will move by, okay, from high pressure to low pressure. So CO2 is going to want to leave the body. What about oxygen? It will want to enter, and nitrogen we're not really so concerned about. But nonetheless, all of these right here still have to add up to 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so we talked about this alveolus, this capillary network. What's not shown on this diagram, but we did see it in the balloon, is a network of? I see a network of capillaries, okay, but there's something that's not shown on this diagram that you should be aware of. Those, a network of elastic fibers, right, that collapse these alveoli down. Your anatomy book has a really nice picture of those elastic fibers, but not so much in the physiology book. Okay, here we see a bronchiole. I think I mentioned this last time. The bronchiole is missing something compared to the trachea and bronchi.
Cartilage.
It doesn't have cartilage, that's right. So, but it does have smooth muscle. There can be bronchoconstriction or dilation. And if there's damage to an alveolus, then that can also affect these bronchioles so that they collapse during expiration. Like when somebody has emphysema, the shape of these alveoli change. Right, they, instead of having maybe 100 in one alveolar sac, you might just have a couple, and that disrupts the integrity of this bronchiole so that when you increase the pressure inside your thorax, the bronchiole collapses. So if the bronchiole collapses, what can you tell me about the air inside this really big, huge alveolus? It just stays there, right? So somebody with emphysema has trouble breathing because they cannot exhale as a result of that, because of these bronchioles that collapse. Does anybody know what the number one reason for emphysema is?
Smoking.
Yeah, smoking. Any kind of smoking. And cigarettes might be the least damaging to the lung compared to what a lot of other people smoke. Okay. Pulmonary circulation. Well, you know, pulmonary circulation is different than systemic circulation since it's very... The length of these vessels are very small, the resistance decreases, so the right ventricle doesn't have to develop nearly the same kind of pressure to get blood flowing through the lungs. And so the right ventricle is a lot weaker. Pulmonary arterial. Okay, here is something that's pretty important. So I'm going to draw something on the board. And let's look at first systemic circulation versus pulmonary. Okay, so here we have an arteriole. We got a capillary bed, right, and then a venule right over here. And what's right at the entrance to this capillary bed? A sphincter, a pre-capillary sphincter, right? Right there. And I mentioned something about local control. That precapillary sphincter is not innervated, right? So there are no nerve reflexes going to it, but it can constrict and dilate. And why does it constrict or dilate? Since it's local control, it's by what's in the local neighborhood right here, right? So if this is a tissue at rest and there is high oxygen, all right, high O2, low CO2, what's going to be the effect on this precapillary sphincter? Right, if there's high oxygen, does this tissue need more oxygen? All right, so this is going to lead to constriction. Okay, now what about if there is low oxygen, high CO2? Maybe high ADP, right? Because that's something that will happen under low oxygen conditions. What is this? What's the effect on this precapillary sphincter? It's going to dilate. All right, so what circulation is this? Systemic circulation, and what kind of control? Local control. Pulmonary circulation has local control as well. And generally, when you think of the pulmonary circulation compared to the systemic circulation, what's one thing that kind of comes to mind? Okay, yeah, they're different, but tell me about arteries and veins in terms of what they carry. Systemic circulation, arteries are high in oxygen. Pulmonary circulation, arteries are low in oxygen. So they're kind of opposite. Right, so that's the concept I want you to start thinking about, something that's opposite. So there for sure are capillaries in the pulmonary. Here are some pulmonary capillaries. Pulmonary capillary still has precapillary sphincter. And now we have an alveolus, right? We have an alveolus in here. And there's air inside this alveolus. And what's condition? Here we have, let's say, high oxygen inside this alveolus, so there is high oxygen around this capillary bed. What could be the effect of high oxygen on this precapillary sphincter? Systemic circulation, it causes constriction, okay? But in the lungs, this high oxygen concentration is going to cause dilation. Okay, so why is that? Because blood doesn't need to go to an alveolus that's low on oxygen, because the purpose is to go and pick up oxygen. All right. If you have an alveolus, let's put another one down over here. If you have a capillary going to it, if you have an alveolus over here that is low in oxygen, what happens to this precapillary sphincter? Let me put in O2. Okay, this low O2 is going to cause constriction. All right, so that's just local control, and the pulmonary and systemic circulations are opposite. This is important that it constricts, because if you have a lot of blood going to alveoli that don't have oxygen, then you're not oxygenating your blood. Right, so that makes perfect sense. And it should be that local control works opposite in the pulmonary compared to the systemic circulations due to local control. So this thing right here does something. It's what maintains the proper ventilation to perfusion ratios. Ventilation just means how much air is moving in and out of the alveolus. And perfusion means how much blood is going to that particular alveolus. Right, so blood goes to the part of the lung that has high oxygen and is detoured away from the part of the lung that has low oxygen. Okay, that's really the important part of these slides right here. So how do we control respiration? Well, we know that the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, so we do have voluntary control. We could all hold our breath, right, and stop ventilating until we pass out. We could all do that. I've never talked a whole class into doing that, but that would be fun sometime. And then when we pass out, we would start breathing again, because there are some automatic centers, right, in the brainstem that help control breathing. It's not part of the autonomic nervous system, but it operates automatically. Okay, so here are three centers that I want you to know a little bit about. Okay, and one is in the medulla, right, and there are two in the pons, and they're closely associated with each other, and maybe they overlap in some circumstances, right? But the rhythmicity center, you should think of that as like being the SA node for inspiration. What can you tell me about SA node? What does the SA node do? Yeah, it's a pacemaker, causes contraction of the heart. All right, so this rhythmicity center is going to send impulses down the spinal cord to the motor neurons that are in the spinal cord that go to the diaphragm, for instance. It has its own normal rate. And what can you tell me about the SA node? Does it just sit there, or does it listen to things? It's listening to the autonomic nervous system, right? Like sympathetic for excitation, parasympathetic for inhibition. Well, there's no autonomic nervous system, but there are a couple other nuclei in the pons that affect this rhythmicity center. The apneustic center is something that promotes inspiration. Apneustic center promotes inspiration, so when it sends signals down to the rhythmicity center, right, that increases the depth and probably the rate of inspiration as well. Right, so maybe you put like a big positive sign here by the rhythmicity center. And then above that is the pneumotaxic area. The pneumotaxic area, right, will inhibit the apneustic center. Right, so if the apneustic center is inhibited, what happens to inspiration? It decreases, right? It decreases. Some people have a problem with the pneumotaxic center to where the apneustic area is working all the time. Let's consider what would happen then. If the apneustic center is not inhibited by the pneumotaxic center, what is somebody going to be doing all the time? Would be, you know what? Hyperventilation would be a really good guess, but they can't even exhale. Right? They're going to be trying to inhale all the time. And of course, that would be really uncomfortable if you can't even hardly force yourself to exhale. That's called apneusis. So apneusis is a condition where somebody's just forcibly trying to inhale all the time. And usually that's due to damage right here in the pneumotaxic area. Right. So, and people can get a stroke, right, in various parts of the brain. They can get a stroke in the pons or the medulla, and that can produce a lot of other kinds of strange effects. Okay. It might be that this whole automatic breathing center is destroyed, right? And so a person, when they inspire and expire, it's by just their conscious thought. So every time that they want to breathe, they consciously have to think about it, just like contracting a biceps muscle. All right. So now when they're sleeping, that is a problem. How do they breathe when they're sleeping? They can't breathe when they're asleep. Right, so they're going to be waking up all the time, but of course then they're put on a respirator, right? And does anybody know what that condition is called? Sleep apnea is really close. But somebody with sleep apnea still can breathe by themselves to some degree when they're asleep. I want to talk about sleep apnea because it's fun in just a second. But the condition I'm talking about where somebody just can't breathe at all when they're sleeping, okay, is called Odin's curse. Odin's curse is a condition where every breath a person takes, it has to be voluntarily initiated. And you can imagine what that is like, but you probably have a really fancy respirator when you try to fall asleep. Okay. Well, somebody mentioned something about sleep apnea. Right? Sleep apnea might have something to do with these respiratory centers, but more than likely we think it has to do with just the formation of your nasal cavity and your pharynx and the soft palate and maybe something about the larynx, to where when you sleep all those muscles relax and these passageways constrict and it's really hard to get air through those passageways. And as a result, you have a tendency to stop breathing when you're sleeping. Well, after you don't breathe for 30 seconds or so, how do you feel? Not very good. Okay, what kind of nervous system becomes activated? Sympathetic nervous system becomes activated. What happens to heart rate? It increases. What happens to total peripheral resistance? Okay, yeah, sympathetic causes what? Vasoconstriction of blood vessels. Okay, so even though somebody really doesn't notice it all night long, their sympathetic nervous system is stimulated, so their blood pressure can be sky high. Right, so sleep apnea is actually a very serious condition because it can cause heart failure, and it can cause heart failure on the right side of the heart. Right? It can cause right-sided heart failure, which is pretty strange. How can it cause failure of the right side of the heart? Well, let's look at the circulation over here. Right, pulmonary, local control. When somebody is in sleep apnea, what happens to all of the air inside these alveoli? Oxygen decreases. What happens to local control? All these precapillary sphincters constrict because the lungs know, gee whiz, we don't need to be pumping blood to all these alveoli where there's no oxygen, right? Because that's how the lung is set up. All right, so if there's constriction right here, all right, if so if the resistance of all these blood vessels in the lungs increases, what happens to pressure in the pulmonary circulation? It has to increase to overcome this constriction. Right, and what do we call high blood pressure? Hypertension. Yeah, so this produces hypertension of the pulmonary circulation. And what's the side of the heart that pumps blood to the pulmonary circulation? The right side of the heart, right? And that can cause failure of the right side of the heart. So it's another reason why sleep apnea really should be diagnosed and treated. And one way to kind of tell is if somebody snores a lot, that they're very restless when they're sleeping, could be an indication that they have sleep apnea. Okay. And in lab, I think you actually were able to measure something about the heart, if there was hypertrophy of the right ventricle, right? If the right ventricle starts to hypertrophy, maybe due to this constriction right here, what happens to the mean electrical axis of the heart? Did you guys do mean electrical axis in lab yet? No? Okay, maybe you didn't do it. Well, there's a way to measure what the electrical axis of the heart is, and when the right ventricle becomes hypertrophied, then the vector analysis of that electrical activity shifts to the right. Right? And so that's a way of measuring something about the right ventricle, which otherwise is really difficult to do. Right? We can't really measure pulmonary pressure. Where would we have to put a blood pressure cuff to measure pulmonary pressure? Would anybody in here volunteer for that? No, because, right, we'd have to open up somebody's chest, right, and get to a pulmonary artery, for instance, right? So that's really difficult. Easy to measure systemic blood pressure. Okay, so that's some funny things about the respiratory center. The apneustic and pneumotaxic center. So under normal circumstances, how is respiration controlled? And by this respiratory center in the pons and the medulla. Well, your body has to measure chemicals. What kind of receptor do you need for chemicals? You need chemoreceptors, right? And so there are chemoreceptors that can monitor CO2 and oxygen and also pH inside the blood. And some of these things are located in the medulla, but there's also some located on the arch of the aorta. And remember, what else is really important about the arch of the aorta? There's another kind of special receptor there. Yeah, baroreceptors, right? Baroreceptors. Okay, so the receptors in the medulla are what we call central receptors because they're not central in your body, but they're in the central nervous system, right? And then there are peripheral chemoreceptors, which I mentioned over here in the aortic bodies, and there's even some up here in the carotid sinus. Those are the carotid bodies. Okay. So automatic breathing. Right, here we have the medulla oblongata with the rhythmicity center, and it's controlled by the other centers that are up there, and like the apneustic and pneumotaxic center. And the pons can be influenced by the cerebral cortex as well. Emotional stimulus can influence the rate and depth of breathing. And so here is where the chemoreceptors in the aortic and carotid bodies send information to the medulla, and the medulla itself even has chemoreceptors, so it can monitor CO2, pH, and oxygen, and adjust, right, the action potentials going down to the diaphragm. Those are what carried by these motor neurons, right, to respiratory muscles. Okay, so let's look at the effects of carbon dioxide and pH first, and then we're going to look at oxygen. All right, so chemoreceptors can modify ventilation to maintain proper levels of CO2, oxygen, and acidity. And the most important mechanism for doing that has to do with this buffer system that we've looked at. All right, so if we have carbon dioxide, it can combine with water and become carbonic acid. Carbonic acid can dissociate into this hydrogen ion, and anybody remember what this thing over here is called? This is bicarbonate, right? Okay, so what about these arrows? Are they one-way? Two-way, freely reversible, right? So these different compounds can go to the right or they can go to the left, and what determines which way these chemicals are going to move? The concentration, yeah, and what do we call that principle? Yeah, Le Chatelier's principle, right? And this reaction is very fast because there's an enzyme that can convert these various chemicals, and what's the name of the enzyme? That was maybe even on the first test, maybe. Yeah, carbonic anhydrase, right? Carbonic anhydrase makes this reaction go back and forth very, very quickly. Okay, hyperventilation, when we breathe rapidly and deeply, okay, we lose a lot of CO2. We're going to exhale a lot of CO2, and we call that hypocapnia when we lose CO2, but what's also going to happen to the pH of your body when you hyperventilate? What are you really breathing out of your body? You're breathing CO2 out of your body. Which way is this carbonic anhydrase reaction going to move? If we get rid of CO2, then it's going to be driven to the left, and when it's driven to the left, what happens to hydrogen ions and bicarbonate? Yeah, it goes down. All right, so what do we call it when the hydrogen ion concentration goes down in your body? Does it become acidic or more basic? More basic, yeah, that's an alkalosis. So people can experience a respiratory alkalosis when they hyperventilate. So we're all very weird alien kinds of beings, because when we exhale, what's one way to think about, what are we exhaling from our body? Acid, Yeah, when we exhale. Okay, fortunately, it's not that caustic. Okay, and the opposite effect can happen when you hypoventilate. That will produce increased levels of CO2. That's hypercapnia. So what's the name? Oh, it tells you right there. Okay. Effects of CO2 and pH on ventilation. Okay, I think I talked about that already. Of all the compounds that we mentioned, CO2, oxygen, and pH, which one do you think would be maybe the best to monitor to adjust respiratory rate? Which one do you think is really important? CO2. You guys have taken this class already. Mm-hmm. I never thought that. I always thought it would be oxygen, right? Because you need oxygen for oxidative phosphorylation to make ATP. Can't live without ATP. So I thought oxygen would be the best chemical to measure in your body, but you guys are right. It is not. It is CO2. Okay. So there are brain chemoreceptors, right? And they have the greatest effect on adjusting ventilation, right? And it's based on pH. But hydrogen ion is an ion, and it can't get across the blood-brain barrier. But CO2, a gas, is very permeable across the blood-brain barrier. Right? And so CO2 has the greatest effect on respiration because it can enter the brain, and because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction, it can decrease the pH, and that's going to have a drastic effect on ventilation rate. Right? So the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain an arterial pCO2 of about 40 millimeters of mercury. That's going to be an important number for you to remember. The peripheral chemoreceptors don't respond to pCO2. They respond directly to acidity, hydrogen ion. All right, so what about this hydrogen ion on the brain? Can hydrogen ion get into the brain? It can't. But something can that's related to hydrogen ion concentration, and that is CO2. And so how is hydrogen ion and CO2 related to each other? What's the name of that reaction? The carbonic anhydrase reaction, right? Carbonic anhydrase, which is this one right over here. Here's CO2 on the left. Here's hydrogen ion way on the right. See double-ended arrows in both of these circumstances. So these things can interconvert very quickly and freely. So here is an illustration of what we've talked about so far. What are we looking at? Well, I see some connective tissue, and then I see some blood in the capillary because we're interested. Oh, no, that's just the wall of the capillary down over here. We've got some CO2 in a capillary, and I have some cerebral spinal fluid, and there's a blood-brain barrier between the blood in this capillary and the CSF. And what cannot go across this blood-brain barrier? Hydrogen ions can't get across, but CO2 can, right? And when it gets into cerebral spinal fluid, right, if CO2 concentrations increase, what's going to happen to it? Because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction, right, that's going to generate carbonic acid, which dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions. These hydrogen ions now can bind to chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata and adjust respiratory rate. So which way do you think respiratory rate would go as your pH decreases? Well, it would increase respiration, right? As CO2 increases, respiration will increase as well. Okay, here is the important graph to visualize. So we're comparing the effects of, right, CO2, changes in CO2 on ventilation rate. So the vertical axis is ventilation rate in terms of liters per minute. We call that minute volume, how much volume of air we're moving out of our lungs in 1 minute as we change carbon dioxide. And so we can see this top scale, right, as we go from left to right, is increasing or decreasing as we go from left to right? It is increasing, right? So CO2 is increasing, right? And we also want to compare that to oxygen. And look at this scale down here for oxygen. As you go from left to right, what happens to oxygen? It is decreasing, right? So these two axes compare very nicely to each other. You would expect as CO2 increases, oxygen is going to decrease. Or if oxygen increases, CO2 is going to decrease because of this ventilation rate. Well, let's take a look at CO2. Okay, normally, percent CO2 is maybe about 1 or 2% in the blood. Okay, and let's pick something in here, maybe like 3. All right, what happens to ventilatory rate if we double the concentration, double the percentage of CO2 from 3 to 6? Does minute volume change at all? Yeah, look at that. It goes from 20 to 40. It doubles, right? So if there's a doubling in CO2, was that a doubling to 6? Yeah, if there was a doubling in CO2, ventilatory rate doubles as well. Right, so there's what? I guess one way to think of this is there's a very nice direct relationship between carbon dioxide concentration in your body and minute volume. Let's look at oxygen. And let's look at oxygen way down over here at 16%. Right, and let's cut it in half. Let's go from 16 to 8. What was the change in ventilatory rate by cutting oxygen in half in our body? It hardly changed at all. Right, so changes, small changes in oxygen or even large changes in oxygen concentration don't affect minute volume very much. Right? But small changes in CO2 affect ventilatory rate drastically. Okay? And that's because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction producing hydrogen ions. Right, lung is a pretty delicate tissue. And it would be possible for you to rip lung tissue if we overinflated our lungs. So there are stretch receptors in lung tissue. And these stretch receptors, when they start to stretch, they inhibit inspiration. That's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. So that you don't overinflate your lungs and that prevents damage to the lungs. Your lungs are probably one of the most delicate tissues in your body. Right, so just remember, Herring-Brewer reflex inhibits inspiration that prevents overinflation. So how are these compounds transported in the blood? So we want to be interested in CO2 and oxygen, and let's consider oxygen first and look at CO2 in just a little bit. Well, oxygen doesn't necessarily have a high solubility in water. Carbon dioxide does, but oxygen doesn't. So how is oxygen transported by our blood? Since our blood is mostly water, and oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in it. Yeah, that's why our blood has red blood cells, and our red blood cells are loaded with a compound called hemoglobin, and every hemoglobin molecule can bind 4 of these oxygen molecules. Okay. So loading of hemoglobin occurs in the lungs and unloading in the tissues, right? So oxygen is delivered from lungs to various tissues. And the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen changes depending on a number of physiologic conditions, like maybe pH, maybe temperature, and composition of some metabolites, right? So how oxygen binds to hemoglobin can change. Here is a model of hemoglobin. It contains this iron group, and there are 4 chains put together, and that's why one hemoglobin molecule can carry 4 oxygens, right? And this is what we call the quaternary structure of a protein, when we can put different kinds of proteins together to form a molecule. Okay. Here we have a compressed gas, right, which is oxygen in this cylinder. And we have a nice regulator, so we can regulate how much oxygen is going to be bubbled through these 2 different containers. And we're going to adjust the pressure so that the PO2 is 100 millimeters of mercury. That's a pressure that's going to force oxygen through both of these chambers. The first chamber just has plasma. The second chamber has plasma and red blood cells. Okay, so how much oxygen? Let's compare how much oxygen these 2 different volumes of whole blood and plasma can contain. All right, so we're bubbling oxygen at 100 millimeters of mercury through plasma, right? And then we stop and measure how much oxygen is in there, and for every 100 mLs, there is 0.3 mLs of oxygen at standard temperature and pressure, right? We can measure that. And if we bubble whole blood with 100 millimeters of mercury, and then stop and measure how much oxygen is in there, and we take all the oxygen off of the hemoglobins, we have 20 mLs of oxygen for every 100 mLs of blood. So what is that like? Is that, that's almost 100 times more oxygen with red blood cells compared to without red blood cells. So that's the job of these red blood cells. And each one of these red blood cells has about almost 300 million hemoglobin molecules in it. So much hemoglobin that there's no room for a nucleus. That's why the lifespan of a red blood cell is very short. Maybe it's about 120 days, something like that, because it can't repair itself. It doesn't have room for other organelles, like mitochondria. Right? And so it is low on ATP. It can make a little bit of ATP, but what kind of process can this red blood cell make ATP? Anaerobic, which is glycolysis. Yeah, so it can make some ATP. So these are living cells because it can make some ATP, but only for glycolysis. And so I find that very ironic. Why is that ironic? Who knows? What does irony mean? It's really hard to define. Okay. It's ironic. An example of irony would be when somebody has a fire in their house, and their house burns down, and it just so happens that it's a fireman that owns the house, right? You just wouldn't expect that to happen. That would be an example of irony. So irony, okay, in this particular case, is that these red blood cells carry oxygen everywhere in your body, but can they utilize oxygen? They cannot because they don't have mitochondria. So I find that pretty ironic, but that's really neither here nor there. Okay. Because they don't use it. They don't have mitochondria. They just have glycolysis going on, right? Just anaerobic metabolism. Okay, some forms of hemoglobin. Carboxyhemoglobin is that heme group combined with carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide has a high affinity for hemoglobin. As a matter of fact, it's 210 times stronger compared to oxygen. Right, and so if carbon monoxide is bound to hemoglobin, oxygen can't. And so what condition happens then when you have high carbon monoxide? It prevents binding, prevents oxygen binding with hemoglobin. That's like being strangled. It's like not breathing, right, if your blood can't carry oxygen. So carbon monoxide is very poisonous. And one good antidote would be to put somebody in a high oxygen concentration. And how many oxygens, so we got a hemoglobin right here. Here we got hemoglobin, and it's bound to carbon monoxide, right? You all recognize that as carbon monoxide, not carbon dioxide, but carbon monoxide. High affinity, right? To get this carbon monoxide off, how many oxygen molecules am I going to have to put on the board? Usually I get really good answers before I finish. Yeah, 210. All right, so very small concentrations of carbon monoxide are deadly as a result of that. Okay. Here is a table. I want you to look at this table. All right, but there's a better way to look at it, and there's a graph on the very next slide. But this table just shows us how the partial pressure of oxygen, okay, will change binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. And we call that percent oxyhemoglobin. So oxyhemoglobin is hemoglobin that has oxygen bound to it, right? And if we decrease oxygen pressure, partial pressure, what happens to percent oxyhemoglobin? It decreases, right? So what's that relationship right there? It is directly related, right? So the percent of oxygen bound to hemoglobin to make oxyhemoglobin is directly related to the partial pressure of oxygen, right? In arterial blood, the partial pressure is about 100 millimeters of mercury, and venous blood is 40. So I'm going to ask you to just memorize those two important landmarks, right? Arterial blood, oxygen is, of course, higher than venous blood by about 60 millimeters of mercury. And what about the percent binding to hemoglobin? What is it in arterial blood? Okay. What's a percentage of hemoglobin that's bound to oxygen? Or what's a percentage of oxygen? Yeah, hemoglobin bound with oxygen? It is right here. 75%, right? So even in venous blood, what can you tell me about red blood cells? Most of them have oxygen, right? Okay, but what is the percentage of oxygen in arterial blood? It's 97, all right? So how much oxygen is delivered to your tissues? Even though 75% is still bound to oxygen in your veins, okay, it is what? The difference between these two numbers, right? So it's the difference of these two numbers that is driving your aerobic metabolism. So it really doesn't matter what the absolute numbers are, but it's how much that is delivered to tissues is what we're concerned about. So if we take all those numbers and plot it out, right, percent oxyhemoglobin versus the partial pressure of oxygen, right, we get a curve that shows there's a direct relationship, but it has kind of a funny curve to it, almost looks like a sigmoid curve, right? And what's the partial pressure of oxygen in veins? About 40. What's it in an artery? About 100. Okay, and so how much, so the difference is how much oxygen is delivered to tissue. So, yeah, so here we have what? Oxygen content in mLs on the right-hand side and percent oxyhemoglobin saturation on the left, so we can compare these two different numbers. So here is 100%. When arteries have 100 millimeters of mercury of partial pressure of oxygen, what's the saturation of hemoglobin? It's pretty much 100%, right? Maybe you can change this a lot and the percentage is still going to be the same. Okay, in venous blood, right, we see that it's maybe about 75. And the difference, remember, is the amount of oxygen that's delivered to tissues. Okay, here is another table. Kind of hard to understand, but I'm going to show you how to analyze this pretty quickly. Here we have a table that shows pH and how the affinity of oxygen changes with hemoglobin. Right, so what's the pH of our blood, typically? Yeah, 7.35, 7.4. So 7.4 is what we're going to call normal. And we're just going to say oxygen has a normal affinity for hemoglobin at this pH. All right, and as we become more acidic, what happens to pH? Does it go to 7.6 or 7.2? 7.2. All right, and oxygen affinity decreases, right, when there's an increase in when there's an increase in acidity or the pH number goes down, right, from 7.4 to 7.2. And as your body becomes more basic, then the affinity for oxygen and hemoglobin increases. And we can look at all these different concentrations right here. Right, but really what I want to see is this graph. Remember that sigmoidal type curve that we saw initially? And what are some landmarks that we want to look at? 40 versus 100, right? Comparing arterial and venous blood. And we just have percent oxyhemoglobin saturation. So we got three different curves. So the first question I have, does pH change the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin? If we change the pH, does the affinity change? I got three different curves at three different pHs, right? So pH definitely changes the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin. If it didn't, then we would only have one curve right here, right? But we got three different curves because we're looking at three different pHs. Okay, well, let's look at the normal circumstance first. How much oxygen is delivered to tissues? Well, it's 100 here, and it's about, what's 40 right here? Maybe 75. So what is that? 25% is delivered to tissues under normal conditions. Now, let's look when your body becomes acidic. Your pH drops to 7.2. What kind of conditions might cause a drop in pH or an increase in acidity? What produces lactic acid? Exercise, yeah, anaerobic respiration, exercise, right? So you have a decrease, so you have high metabolism causes a decrease in pH. What would you like to see in terms of oxygen delivery when you have exercise taking place? An increase. Let's see if that's what happens. All right, so you have a decrease in pH, right? In the arterial supply, what's the binding even at a pH of 7.2? is still basically 100, even at that pH. Now let's go down to 40, which is what we're going to be looking at. All right, here, the bottom curve, which is what we're going to be looking at for veins. Now, what's the percent saturation in veins? 60% instead of 75. So under what conditions is this blood delivering more oxygen to your tissues? Normal pH or acidic pH? Acidic pH, which is what we'd expect. Okay, so here is the last thing that I want you to see, which is pretty easy. Which way did the curve shift? Right, when it became more acidic, did it shift to the right or to the left? It shifted to the right. And what happened to oxygen delivery with a right shift? It increased. That's the bottom line that I want you to see. When this oxyhemoglobin saturation curve shifts to the right, then what happens to tissues? They get more oxygen. All right, so that's the right shift is really what I want you to look at. Okay, and we'll finish up next time. Sign-in sheet is going around, right? But remember, a right shift is delivering more oxygen to your tissues.